This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Indiana University Northwest, which is, of course, based in Gary, is offering up a new bachelor's degree curriculum program in neuroscience. Well, what's neuroscience and why is it important? That's why we have a chance to talk with Assistant Professor of Psychology Maureen Rutherford about it. And thank you for joining us on the program today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, let's ask the dumb question number one. What is neuroscience all about and why is it so important, especially if you want to study it in college? Because there are so many applications out there in the real world that people should take advantage of.
Absolutely, and thank you for asking. So neuroscience in general is the study of the nervous system. It's really critical that we study the nervous system because it's really the center of everything. It controls our thinking, it controls our behaviors, it controls physiology. And so there are many applications of this. There are hundreds of disorders that involve the nervous system. Mm-hmm. And so understanding how the nervous system is working to control behavior and physiology helps us to understand how we can, you know, treat disorders and what does that mean for people and functioning.
We're talking basically, in this case here, being a college curriculum series, it's going to be able to help teach students of all ages, I assume, more about, opportunities that will apply in healthcare fields, in other science fields as well, too, I understand.
One of my favorite things about neuroscience is that it is so interdisciplinary, and so we're drawing on a lot of really awesome resources at IU Northwest. We have a really strong psychology program, and also the other life sciences, biology and chemistry that we're going to be drawing from. And that's going to help students prepare for a broad variety of career pathways because they're getting so many different perspectives on anything involving the nervous system.
So I guess, too, that there's some opportunities to train people, and not only if they want to go on and become nurses or even become doctors, they have a chance to get some experience and learn some things that will be able to pay off in careers like in lab tech work.
Absolutely. And so part of the curriculum is their senior capstone is to do research in the neuroscience lab. And what the students will do is they design a project and they collect the data and analyze it. And so, you know, a lot of students come in thinking that, oh, well, you know, this is really only going to apply if I do research. And that's not really true because this is also going to involve, like, information literacy and using data, which, you know, a lot of career pathways will use. Figuring out how to present numbers in a certain way and interpreting those. Also being able to explain how they got to, like, what was the purpose of doing this project, and also how to, what does that mean for somebody who may not be trained in science? Like, that's really one of the goals of really me as a teacher, being able to have people spread that information and do it in a way that makes sense and that is correct.
Now, since this curriculum series is going to be offered in the Department of Psychology, you have to have partners, obviously, in other parts of the Indiana University Northwest campus to be able to help make these courses really relevant to students. Tell us about these other partners that the department's working with.
The other departments that we're partnering with would be mainly biology and chemistry. We also are drawing part of the curriculum from computer science. Like I said, you know, using software packages and programs is essential for the students to know how to use. You know, we have some really great expertise in those other departments that students will have a chance to learn from. Like I said, the curriculum itself is very interdisciplinary. Mm-hmm. So they'll get hands-on lab work in not only the neuroscience lab, but also in those bio and chem labs as well.
We're talking with the Assistant Professor of Psychology, Maureen Rutherford, at Indiana University Northwest about the offering for the first time, I understand, at least here in the region, of a bachelor's degree in neuroscience. How distinctive is it to have a first in this respect?
I'm actually really excited about that because I was actually born and raised in the region. I attended IU Northwest, and I was always kind of interested in the inner workings of the brain as well. And so that wasn't really an option for me when I was attending school in the region. I was able to go get my graduate work right outside do my graduate work in Chicago, mm-hmm. and then come back and be able to bring you know, some of my expertise now back to the region to help students learn more about this really, really exciting area that, like, many, many places offer this, but, you know, was still somewhat lacking in the region.
Now, if anybody is interested, whether they're a current IU Northwest student or somebody who's interested in taking classes at IU Northwest, how do they go about getting themselves lined up to be able to get into the curriculum to be able to get this bachelor's degree in neuroscience?
Absolutely. So if you're already a current student, just come and talk to either myself or somebody else in the department. If you're an interested student, just check out the website, apply, or talk to somebody admissions. Also, I'm always willing to talk to students that are really interested or prospective students that are interested in the curriculum. So website, email, call, get in touch.
What type of opportunities will students have, besides, of course, taking the courses at IU Northwest, to maybe able to be able to do some internship work in some other fields that are related, to be able to work towards the degree?
We do offer an internship course here in the psychology department. There's also opportunities for possibly doing lab work. I have a student right now that's working with one of my colleagues over in Illinois, doing a little bit of work in her lab. And so there are opportunities for the students to get kind of more hands-on work, either through internships or these work opportunities, as well as doing, you know, independent research in the labs on campus is also an opportunity as well.
Do you also think, too, that over time, since this is brand new, that there will be some opportunities to get some internship opportunities here in Northwest Indiana?
Yeah, that would be awesome. So if anybody out there has some sort of link to neuroscience, I'd be more than happy to chat with them about getting students in and getting students some opportunities for those experiences.
Mm-hmm. Is there any information that's up on the IU Northwest website right now or will be in the weeks and months ahead to let more people know about the fact that this new BS series is coming up in neuroscience?
Yes, absolutely. There's descriptions on the IU Northwest Psychology Department page. There are links to the degree descriptions for both the BS and the BA. We have both a BS and BA option for neuroscience. And so if students are interested, they can check that out there. And my contact information is there as well as contact information for the department.
Well, Professor Rutherford, thank you very much for your help today, and we'll get the word out. And hopefully people will check out the IU Northwest website if they are interested in pursuing a bachelor's degree in neuroscience. And we appreciate you talking about it today.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Maureen Rutherford is an assistant professor in psychology. The Department of Psychology at the IU Northwest campus in Gary is the first now, making IU Northwest the first in the region to be able to offer a degree program in neuroscience. Let's check on some Porter County recycling news coming from the Porter County Recycling and Waste Reduction District. And with us to talk about it, Donna Stuckert. Donna, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking.
Hi, Chris.
Well, we know this is going to be the last opportunity. The folks that have that old paint and that old motor oil or whatever may happen to be, maybe even a gas oil mix and that happens to be out in the garage there from the old mower, you have a chance to officially and legally get rid of it here. Another household hazardous waste drop-off day. Tell us about that coming up.
That's right. The very last household hazardous waste collection event for all Porter County residents is Saturday, October 12th at the Porter County Fairgrounds. Now, unlike the previous event at the fairgrounds, which was in May, we are not collecting tires.
Mm-hmm.
So this is for household hazardous waste only. So it's those products that contain corrosive, toxic, ignitable, or reactive ingredients that require special care upon disposal. And you're right, that's your old gasoline, your old antifreeze, your all those poisons that you might have, herbicides, disinfectants, all those kinds of things you may have in your garage or your shed or your basement. And some of them you probably don't even know what they are anymore because
yeah.
The labels have, you know, rubbed off. And, you know, those are the kinds of things that we want you to bring to these collection events because, quite frankly, a lot of those things that people bring in are recycled. Our contractor is able to recycle those chemicals and use them again in different ways. And if not recycled, then they are disposed of in an environmentally friendly way.
Yeah, they probably have companies that have to deal with this on a daily basis from factories and other industries all across the region. So adding what they happen to pick up from Porter County residents is just something to add to the mix.
Absolutely, correct.
Now, you say that the next, in fact, the last household hazardous drop-off day is going to be coming up here in October. And just past that, in fact, the next month after that, in November, it's going to be America Recycles Day. And you folks have got something really, really special that's underway, trying to get people, to the artists and everybody, I'm sure, or maybe some people, maybe not everybody. But the idea is that get those artists out there to come up with some really clever ideas, and particularly in the school system. Tell us what the art project's all about and the contest this year.
Well, this is our third annual America Recycles Day billboard contest, and it is for students in 6th through 12th grades that are going to school in Porter County, and that's public and private schools, and they can create a design that may be featured on billboards throughout Porter County to advertise America Recycles Day throughout Porter County and to encourage people to recycle, because it is the only nationally recognized day dedicated to the promotion of recycling programs in the United States.
I know that you have a deadline for anybody that has some artwork that they'd like to submit to be able to make it eligible to maybe get on that poster, that billboard out there. Tell us about the deadline and what people need to do if they're interested in participating.
The artwork needs to be at our office no later than Friday, October 18th. And information and packets are can be downloaded from our website, which is portercountyrecycling.org. And we will narrow those entries down to finalists, and then three winners will be selected from the finalists. And those three winners will have their artwork rotated on billboards throughout Porter County the entire month of November.
Wow, that sounds great.
Yes.
While we're at it here, we've had updates, and this is time probably for another update. We've mentioned in our past conversations about the fact that they had Porter County residents who may have been well-meaning in their decisions to recycle, but they're not really doing it right. And we've tried to put out a little primer on what can and cannot be recycled in the Porter County containers these days. How are the containers doing? Are you still having problems with trash in the mix of all the recyclables?
Well, a lot of the problems that are out there at our drop sites right now are things that are left on the ground around the containers.
Mm-hmm.
And people might put mattresses out there, or sofas or chairs, and while those things, I guess you can say, can be recycled, like sofas and chairs or whatever, they can't be recycled by our containers. And those containers really accept the same materials that people can recycle at their curb.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're talking glass bottles and jars, plastic jugs, bottles, jars and containers, and also paper and boxes and cartons like milk, juice, broth. So those are the products that can go into our containers, and anything that's left on the ground is considered dumping, and people can get fined for that.
Now, if anybody does happen to have some material like that to be recycled or reused, at least, certainly with the case of an old sofa that isn't completely beat up, or a chair that isn't completely beat up, or some other type of furniture, are there places out there in Porter County that people can get them to, so they in turn get reused like they should be?
Oh my gosh, yes. I mean, even if you're talking Goodwill or the New Men's Creation Center or the Repurpose Place, there are a ton of places that will take unwanted items. And if you're not sure, please just feel free to give us a call at 465-3694, and we will be happy to give you a list of alternatives on what you can do with some of those items that you no longer want.
Well, Donna, thank you for the information, and the best of luck to everybody who decides to participate in the middle and high school students' art contest, the second second annual, now the third year, a contest for young people in Porter County to show their support for recycling and again, maybe make themselves available to be on a billboard someplace in Porter County. And we thank you for spending time to talk about these things today.
Thank you so much, Chris.
Donna Stuckert is the Public Education Coordinator for the Porter County Recycling and Waste Production District. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. And we welcome back to Regionally Speaking, Greenfleet Radio, and with Greenfleet Radio, here's your host, Carl Lissick.
Well, thank you for that introduction, and today our guests are Mr. Don Babcock, Economic Development Director for NIPSCO, and Mr. Kevin Kirkham, Manager of Business Development for NIPSCO. Gentlemen, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Good morning, Northwest Indiana.
All right,
so glad to be here with Carl and his team. He's done so much for Northern Indiana, and particularly Northwest Indiana, but he's a true leader in the green field of having our future energy sources be better and also more environmentally sensitive.
Well, Don, Kevin, thank you, and thank you very much for those kind words. So I think most of our listeners know NIPSCO, but for those who don't, can you give a quick overview of what NIPSCO is and what you do?
Sure. We cover the northern third of the state from the Ohio state line to the Illinois state line. In Northwest Indiana, we provide both natural gas and electricity. But in other areas, for example, South Bend and Fort Wayne and Wabash Valley, we're just the natural gas provider. We are the largest overall utility in the state on the gas side and second largest on the electric.
Wonderful.
About 800,000 customers in general.
It's a lot of customers.
That is. A lot of people to try to satisfy. Yeah.
And you do a great job also. So when it comes to electric vehicle programs, I know NIPSCO used to offer incentives to help pay for charging station installations at homes and public locations. I understand these programs are no longer offered at the moment, but do you foresee these coming forward in the future?
Yeah, thanks, Carl. Yes, we just recently ended our programs at the beginning of the year. We had some really lucrative programs for customers interested in EVs. We had a time of use rate discount, about 4 cents discount for off-peak charging. And then we also provided earlier incentives to install home charging. And we also helped commercial entities install public charging at their facilities. These programs ended, as you mentioned, at the beginning of the year. We're currently evaluating them. I think they were a very high success. Like all the other programs that we're working on, we're trying to take a holistic approach in analyzing these. And so in 2020, we'll probably come back out with some type of program, maybe be towards the end of the year of 2020, unfortunately. But we're currently under that evaluation process and soon to have programs hopefully available for customers.
Well, I know from working with both of you and a lot of the NIPSCO team, very successful program, and so we would love to see that program come back, not only for Northern Indiana, but for, you know, being an example to the rest of the state. So I know renewable energy is becoming an important focus at NIPSCO with the closure of the NIPSCO coal-fired plants and the incorporation of large solar and wind farms to help cover the needed capacity. So for a small residential customer, is there anything that we can do now to help save that?
Well, sure. One of the things that you can do we actually have a green energy rate. So you can buy some portion of your power for your home by calling us and applying for that rate. We've had that for a number of years, and a number of people do take advantage of it. It would be nice if we had more, frankly, because it sends the right message to us in that encouraging us to do more with renewable. And we like to hear from our customers and our stakeholders to try to make the best decisions possible.
So as Don mentioned, the Green Power Program is probably our least expensive program where we can purchase renewable energy credits on behalf of our customers to signify that they're purchasing green energy and helping that renewable resource. At NIPSCO, as you mentioned, we're doing quite a change in our portfolio, and we're switching our coal-fired fleet to more renewables. And this is really happening because the costs of these renewable energy products are coming down significantly and therefore more economical than the coal-fired fleets. Customers today that are interested in renewable energy beyond just the Green Power Program that want to install solar on their rooftops today, we have two different types of programs. We have a feed-in tariff and a net metering program where they can install the solar entities and really get paid or get a discount off of their energy bill.
So how would people access that, Kevin?
Great question. So if you're interested in renewable energy, we have some great resources on our website at NIPSCO.com. Just look for our services and renewable energy our programs for you, and you can gain a wealth of information and walk you through the process.
Well, there's also beyond mm-hmm. that, too, a lot of energy-saving programs out there. For one, we'll pick up your old refrigerator at your house if it's inefficient and sitting in the garage and using up a lot of electricity. A lot of people don't even recognize that an old refrigerator or an old freezer can be a pretty substantial hit on your electric bill every month. So, and we have a number of rebate programs for lighting and other things, too. So it's a great resource if you go to NIPSCO.com, and you'll see some ways to save energy on your bill.
Wonderful. You're listening to 89.1, the Lakeshore Green Fleet Radio. I'm Carl Lissick with our guests today, Mr. Don Babcock and Mr. Kevin Kirkham from NIPSCO. So we've talked a lot about NIPSCO's programs, can help how they can help residential customers. So how do NIPSCO's sustainability efforts impact our business customers?
Well, the important thing for us is to have sustainable and reliable power for the long term. And we were kind of surprised in that we announced a few years ago we were retiring a big portion of our coal fleet. Now we've announced that we're going to retire all of our coal fleet by 2028. We used to have about 85 or 95% of our power was provided by coal. But the market's changed. And in fact, we were kind of surprised that natural gas we thought it was going to be competitive with particularly the combined cycle gas turbine. But the renewables came in so much lower that we had to make a good decision for the long term for our customers. We expect that over time, because of these decisions, we'll be saving over $4 billion for our customers in the long term.
So as we talk about this, Don and Kevin, what about jobs and economic development in NIPSCO territory with some of these changes that you've encountered?
Well, I think the green economy is coming. Now, there aren't any – it's kind of hard to define specifically mm-hmm. a green job. But what we're finding more and more is in our companies, they do have a specific focus on energy reliability and also energy efficiency. And the steel mills are one of the great examples. They literally measure labor per ton of steel and also energy usage per ton of steel. And that has been going down tremendously over the last 20 years. And keeping them more efficient and keeping them here in Northwest Indiana, they employ probably in the steel-related business about 20,000 people in Northwest Indiana. So it's important for them to stay healthy.
Absolutely. So as we come to the end of our program, any closing thoughts?
Well, just again, Carl, I want to thank you for your leadership at South Shore Clean Cities. I hope, anyway, that you're allowed to expand your services to the whole northern half of the state of Indiana. You set a great example for all of us, and you always remind me when I see all the time. I always think of green when I think Carl Lissick. So it's like Hermit says, right, it's not easy being green. So.
I love it, yeah.
And I'll just add that just as a reminder to customers that are out there, there's a lot of resources that NIPSCO has available. Please take advantage of them. They'll save you a lot of energy and therefore dollars in your pocketbook.
Well, gentlemen, as always, thank you very much for all that you do for Northern Indiana. And that will do it for today's edition of the Green Fleet Radio. Green Fleet Radio airs three times each Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm your host, Carl Lissick. Thanks for joining us. And remember, it's never too late to begin your environmental legacy.
Carl was talking with Kevin Kirkham, who's the manager of new business at NIPSCO, and Don Babcock, who's the economic development director at NIPSCO. Green Fleet Radio is made possible by the South Shore Clean Cities and the Northwestern Indiana Regional Planning Commission. And you can hear Green Fleet Radio here on Regionally Speaking about 1220 on Wednesdays here on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. And you're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. Our next guest here on the program is Lee Conradi, who's the president and CEO of One Region. And One Region is a nonprofit, a 501c3, that its mission is to grow population, attract and retain talent, increase household income here in Northwest Indiana in Lake Porter and LaPorte counties, and more recently has taken on another title of being in charge of the Northwest Indiana Regional Opportunities Council. Thank you for joining us in the program, and will you tell us a little bit about what the council is all about?
Thank you, Chris. So the council is focused on how to attract investments and people to Northwest Indiana. It was created about a year ago. It's a council of CEOs and executives from the private sector and institutions throughout Lake Porter and LaPorte counties. And their top priorities are, again, like, how do you get people to move here and what does that look like? So it's about creating vibrancy and density in our urban core areas. Ensuring that the South Shore Train and its projects happen, such as double tracking and the Westlake extension, fostering transit-oriented development, and then also a focus on the MarTech Greenway.
When you have such an ambitious project like this in particular, how do you go about to get started, since we know that, the South Shore Line has well stated what its intentions are with the expansion of not only the service that's out there now, the routes from Gary to Michigan City on the double tracking section, but also to the West Lake project as well. How do you get things started to try to attract not only people to be able to live in places along the rail lines, but also businesses to locate too?
That's a good question. I mean, there's always a starting place, and that's why we created this council, was to create a focus of what do they see as the top priority and how do you create those investments and a strategy around these priorities. And so one of the things that I've looked at is transit-oriented development, and we've had our South Shore Rail Line for over 100 years, but we're probably one of the only places in the country that has zero transit-oriented development. So one region has led trips to New Jersey, Pittsburgh, and Denver to learn about how these places create a turnaround strategy. And each place has a different story. But what I have found is the private sector has to come to the table, work with the public sector, and create that investment. So the piece that I've specifically looked at with the council is how do you create that investment for gap financing around real estate development? So after going to Pittsburgh, we learned about the Pittsburgh Strategic Investment Fund. We've looked at equitable TOD funds in Indianapolis and Denver. And today we officially launched and announced a $25 million loan and investment program for transit-oriented development in Northwest Indiana, which is very exciting and has, I would say, multiple banks have come together, and they're all members of our Opportunities Council to create this. So we're pretty excited about it.
Do you think that maybe that it's hard to say, you know, what the reasons may have been years ago as the South Shore Line had developed over the years, but do you think it was because it was just a matter of creating the right-of-way, so to speak, or the way for the train tracks and the stations that go along with it to develop over time, and maybe nobody really thought about kind of upgrading the neighborhoods and to be able to include more housing and more business opportunities and the like along those lines?
Not necessarily. I think that, you know, I would use the line that the former mayor of Oklahoma City said, which was that Oklahoma City was built for cars. So if you were a car, Oklahoma City was the place to be. And mm-hmm. So I think that as our region developed, we were kind of that suburban community, and people were driving to the train stations as opposed to creating that walkable factor. And I think our downtowns and urban core areas have seen a shift in population during, you know, the 1970s and 80s, and now it's time to reinvest in that. And that's, you know, Pittsburgh's a good story of what happens when you have a population decline and how do you reinvest to bring people back. And so that's a part of the strategy, is this real estate development strategy.
Now,
I think it's a matter of time, basically.
Does this project in particular, when you're talking about the opportunity for the loan program and the funds that are targeted for these development projects along the route, both routes, actually, we should say, do they come, I guess, in conjunction with whatever the South Shore Line is planning to do?
In terms of the transit-oriented development?
Yeah.
I think so as communities are looking at what is transit-oriented development mean to them, the state of Indiana has been very supportive on this too. They recently, in the last 2 years, passed legislation for transit development districts, and that's to help incentivize creating transit-oriented development. And so this is just another step of how do you leverage financing for that. And the state is looking at TOD, transit-oriented development, within a half mile, and we're looking closer to stations at a quarter mile, and we're using that as a guideline. So we really want to create that walkable amenity around transit stations.
Do you think this is going to be an opportunity here more for, it's going to be a mixed use of projects, I'm sure. So you'll have all types of not only housing, but you'll have business and maybe some commercial in there too. But do you think this maybe might be focused a bit more toward housing? Because we know that the opportunities would be there for people to take the train, say to live in Northwest Indiana, and take the train to go to Chicago, or take the train even to go to South Bend.
Absolutely. Yeah. So we are focused on mixed use development, and that includes housing and then retail generally on the first floor. But we're looking for creative and high quality projects. We're looking for all types of housing projects. I think our focus is especially on market rate housing. which we lack here in the region, especially in terms of rental properties. And we know that that is attractive to both empty nesters and young professionals. So
those are probably the people, I'm sure, that are the most attractive to it, being able to take the train, even for just for a half hour or however it takes to get to whatever their stops are in Chicago.
Absolutely. It is very attractive. And I think that we could do a better job at retaining our talent and, you know, college grads if we had the type of place that they're looking to live, which is walkable rental properties. And that's a gateway to the housing market and home ownership. So, I mean, I think it's a win-win of, you know, creating this investment in development in Northwest Indiana.
Now, I know the council is made up of CEOs and executives in the three counties that are in best use for this, certainly this project, Lake Porter and LaPorte counties. Although the council is focusing here, at least in this particular case, on the loan program involving the banks that are members of the council, what do some of the CEOs and the executives and some of the other business and industry and nonprofits have to say about this?
Everyone's excited. Everyone's in on transit-oriented development and creating that walkable feature. And, you know, I'll use as an example, like downtown Hammond. And downtown Hammond has a Franciscan Hospital, has a court system, has Strachan Van Til, has, Purdue Northwest, not too far. And many, you know, Franciscan, Strachan Van Til, Purdue Northwest are all members of the Opportunities Council. And so for them to have that added value of investing in transit-oriented development in downtown Hammond, and that is just a win-win-win for everybody, not just for Hammond, but for the entire region. And so, again, that's an example. Michigan City is another place that is prime for an opportunity like this. And, again, other business and corporate partners see the value in places across the region. But it's, everybody is excited about it.
Do you think that this is really going to be a truly transformative project? When we talk about, for example, the just work on the main line, double tracking in particular here between Gary and through Michigan City, this is going to do a lot of changing of the landscape and how the trains are running through the region anyway. Do you think that's just going to lend itself even more to a development for this much more dense housing?
I do. I think that we, each municipality, and we as a region, and we as a private sector, have to be intentional about what it is we're looking for. So I want to see from the public sector what their plans are. They need to be intentional about the type of development they want to see. As the former mayor of Pittsburgh has said, not every deal is a good deal. So make sure you know what you want and be very clear about that. And that's been a strong lesson from every place we've looked at. But I think that there's got to be some help on those early projects that have a higher risk because our market isn't caught up yet. And it will once we have some anchor projects and catalytic projects that come to our region.
So there has to be somebody who has to really take the plunge and become the initial developer that wants to come up with a really good idea that is going to take the best advantage of the land that's available to work with, I suppose.
Yeah, and I think, again, being intentional about it and smart about how you approach development and growth is helpful. But I've looked at places, I would say it has to be a holistic project, right, and comprehensive of the community and what the community needs are. We've looked at, an example in Newark, New Jersey, where it was a redeveloped building and it included housing, a Whole Foods, and Rutgers Newark became a part of it and had space in it, and it really became an anchor for downtown Newark. And so it's projects like that that we're looking for that are truly anchors and catalytic in those early projects.
Now, Leah, do you think that in this particular case, when you're talking about a developer that is really interested in following through on the concept of transit-oriented development and with these mixed-use projects, housing and the commercial and the business and the like that's going to come along with it, does this new program lend itself a little differently than the traditional developer going to a bank or a series of banks to get the financing to be able to get the project started?
It doesn't. I mean, it's in some ways traditional financing, and in other ways it's a bit unique in that it's spreading the risk among five different banks, and also terms and conditions are, I would say we have guidelines that we're working with and would be set for each project, but we are looking for creative projects. So
now maybe it's a little early since you've just made the announcement of the new loan program, but are there any developers out there that have gotten with you folks at One Region and other members there of the original Opportunities Council to talk about this idea and say, hey, we're really interested in this?
there are developers who are certainly interested in looking at transit-oriented development throughout Northwest Indiana and creative projects. And I've personally met with some, and I know that other people and organizations in Northwest Indiana have as well. So I think that this is helpful in moving development forward.
Now, getting to the nuts and bolts of this, now that the program is officially launched, what is the procedure now if there is a developer that is interested in taking advantage of it?
The best way is to contact me. You could reach out to the banks as well, but the best way is contact me and through my email or through our website, oneregionnwi.org, and we'll go from there. So we want to hear about projects and ideas, and you know, we're open to it. And we also want to hear, you know, and see from the public sector that municipalities are prepared and ready for development and have looked at the feasibility of projects and done a residential analysis. So we want to see alignment with the public sector as well.
Now, do you think this is going to be a project that not only involving the individual or groups of developers that will get working on this, but also with the communities that are along the line, and also, I guess, too, for that matter, with NERPC, which, of course, runs the South Shore Line?
Yes, I do. I do think that there will be alignment. I mean, I work frequently with our various regional organizations, and NICDI and RDA have been strong collaborators with One Region. And so, yes, continue to have conversations with them and work with them through this. And I do think municipalities will also reach out to us, as well as developers approach them about certain projects and looking at how do we finance the gap on those projects. So.
Now, I'm assuming that over time we're going to see more information about this on the One Region website and other places, too.
Absolutely.
Well, Leah, thank you for taking time to talk with us, explaining what the new development is in the program that the Northwest Indiana Regional Opportunities Council has gotten started, the loan program, working with the member banks on the council to get those developers who are interested in this unique transit-oriented development project going. And we wish you all the best, and thank you for being with us to talk about it today.
Thank you. Thank you so much. It was my pleasure, and look forward to growing Northwest Indiana together.
Leah Conrady is the president and CEO of One Region. They're based, by the way, in Munster, and they are the 501c3 that is working, among other things, to help grow population and attract and to retain not only talent, but also increase household income here in Northwest Indiana. Former state representative Scott Pielat has always been involved in Northwest Indiana business and industry in one way or the other, besides, of course, being a state lawmaker in Indianapolis. But now he's taken on the full-time charge of being the executive director of the Kankakee and Yellow River Basin Development Commission. The panel had been revised by the state law earlier this year to focus more quickly on resolving some of the drainage-related issues that happen on both rivers here in Northwest Indiana. Scott was with us on the program recently to talk about the history of the problems along the Kankakee and the Yellow Rivers, and also some of the needed changes that he is hoping that this revised commission is going to bring.
The Grand Kankakee Marsh was once the second largest freshwater marsh in the United States. And beginning in the 19th century and ending in World War I, there were massive drainage projects that were undertaken by state government and by the local governments. And the reason was pretty basic. They exposed some of the most productive farmland in the world. You know, and this farmland is now a key part of our economy. It's an important component of our tax base for public services here in this region. And it allowed the development of a number of important and historic communities here in the area. But we're still living with the consequences of it because the underlying topography and geology still has this tendency to create marsh-like effects. So we have to deal with the implications of that because certainly we have many eggs in the economic basket with respect to these long ago decisions. And then we have the human factors. And then we have the quality of life issues that remain with us as well. So the state legislature has finally taken very substantive steps to try to deal with the implications of these things that are really 100 years in the making.
When the first commissions, I guess, or actually the whatever predated the commissions,
right,
came about here back in the early 20th century after the big dredging project of 1918 that finished up, you say, 1919. Was there anything that was set up at that time that you know of in looking through the history books to try to find some way to come up with a plan to deal with all of these problems that came about from all that that marshland?
Here's what happened. Yeah. You have eight counties that basically comprise the Kankakee River Basin. And I'll rattle them off as I did before. St. Joe, Marshall, LaPorte, Stark, Porter, Jasper, Lake, and Newton.
And that's actually the way it starts, because it starts in South Bend and moves west.
That's how I name them off.
Yeah.
What happened was is that each county would just battle the river on its own. They would do what seemed to make sense from their own parochial perspective. But there was a tragedy of the commons that happened. Every county sort of acted in its own self-interest, and as a result, we wound up with a worse result for everybody. You know, more flooding, more erosion, more difficulties for agriculture and communities. So in the late 1970s, the Kankakee River Basin Commission was formed by the state legislature. And that's where the process of trying to coordinate drainage policies began. You still had local counties paying for their share of it, but there was some forum to try to get everyone to work in concert. To their credit, that commission got us to the present day, and in tandem with Chris, it was a record flood in 2018. It was a record at two gauges. In tandem with the increase in precipitation and major flood events, and the work of the commission previously, it sort of got the state government to the point where they were willing to make long-term investments in our region to deal with these long-standing problems.
Since the flooding, I guess, is when the real serious work on a long-range plan has gotten underway. Tell us what the project is like right now, and
sure.
Hopefully when will those who will make decisions about this plan will get to see it?
Last year, the state legislature released funds to the Kankakee River Basin Commission and directed that those funds be used to come up with a long-term work plan. And Christopher Burke Engineering was employed to come up with the work plan. It has been presented in draft forms to the commission as it exists now, and we're expecting a draft final report really in another few weeks, mm-hmm. which will then be handed off to the new commission to begin in earnest some of the long-term efforts that are going to need to be undertaken.
That is Scott Pilath. He is the executive director of what is now known as the Kankakee and Yellow River Basin Development Commission. There have been some changes that folks who are serious weather watchers about the situation with weather in Northwest Indiana should know. National Weather Service office based in Romeoville, of course it's officially known as the Chicago National Weather Service office, has made some changes to the flood impact categories that would affect us on the Kankakee River, basically at Shelby and probably other points too in Lake and Porter counties here in Indiana. Let's find out more about the changes, why they're happening, and what kind of impact it may have for you watching the river levels on the Kankakee River. Scott Lincoln is the senior service hydrologist for the National Weather Service in the Chicago area, and he's joining us from the National Weather Service office. Scott, thank you for joining us here on Regionally Speaking today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Well, if you will bring us an idea as to the issues that come about when you have to make some changes in some of these categories, and in particular the flood impact categories. What are, I guess, flood impact categories, and why folks who are very concerned about the river levels on the Kankakee River should know about them?
The flood impact categories are just a way that we differentiate the different magnitudes of flooding. They're not really meant to apply to any particular person or any particular neighborhood, but it allows us to, describe in a relative sense different stretches of the river, or one river versus another river, how serious the flooding is. So typically, a minor flood stage would represent when we're starting to get some lower-end life-threatening impact, maybe to roadways or water that's getting near some homes in areas where people typically would be. And as we get more towards the moderate and major categories, that's when we're talking about water in structures or affecting some kind of critical infrastructure. So in the case of the Kankakee River at Shelby, the reason we are making changes, is over time, we're constantly evaluating, what kinds of impacts we see in a flood, just to make sure that our documentation on what gets impacted at a different water level, we're constantly evaluating that to make sure that it's still representative. And we looked at the Kankakee River at Shelby. We found that it looks like we're you know, we're calling it life-threatening flooding just a little bit too low. Mm-hmm. And it was a conversation we had with the county and also with the Kankakee River Basin Commission. And we basically came to an agreement that we should raise the level so that we're not sending flood warnings as often, maybe for flooding that's not as serious as it's being made out to be with getting a flood warning.
I guess these changes are having a major impact, I suppose, in a way, on how you forecast how high the river happens to be. You can see it, obviously. Even the untrained eye can drive on, like, U.S. 41 and go down that stretch of highway there as you make the crossover from Lake into Newton counties as you're crossing over on the Kankakee River. And that's a very low area anyway, and it seems when the water's awfully high, it's even higher than usual in that particular spot. So it doesn't always, I guess, represent overall how the river's doing, does it?
The forecast will be the same. So, you know, when we forecast 12 foot, we're still going to forecast 12 foot. It's not necessarily going to change how it's forecast. It's just changing the way that we describe the flooding happening on that stretch of river. And so for the Kankakee River at Shelby Gauge, that's the gauge, or, you know, with the stretch of river that we are watching when we're looking at that gauge is roughly from Interstate 65 downstream to the state line. So
right.
We're looking at all the areas that are impacted kind of in that stretch of river and tying that back to the Shelby Gauge. And so it's just a better way it's a better way to describe, you know, the flooding. And in the previous, about 6 years or so, we were averaging about six flood events a year using the old flood stage. So that means people were getting six flood warnings a year. And that made us kind of question, is this really life-threatening flooding that we want to warn people six times a year? It was definitely the location in northeast Illinois and northwest Indiana that had the most flood warnings. And so, you know, that started us to do the review. And in the review, we found that we could probably adjust those levels just a little bit higher so that when we're issuing a flood warning, it's for a little bit more, a little more life-threatening. So the warning really means that's time to take action.
So I guess it makes it more meaningful, I suppose, when the warnings go out there, they're really serious about how the situation is then.
Yeah, that's definitely the goal. You know, we're like I said, we constantly are looking at it. Every time there's a flood event, we go back and look at what things actually flooded, and we make sure it still matches the documentation that we have for that gauge. And you know, sometimes rivers change, or sometimes people build things or remove things from the floodplain that change what's impacted. And something we're always watching. They were not necessarily meant to stay that way. You know, it's a certain level for minor, moderate, or major. It wasn't necessarily meant to stay there forever. And like I said, that's why we constantly are evaluating it to make sure that it's the most meaningful it can be for the community. We obviously don't want to overwarn, and we don't want to underwarn.
We know that the National Weather Service has many, many trained meteorologists and other observers that work out of the office, but you also rely, too, on trained observers out there, people who live in the area, who travel through the area a lot, who are trained in what they're supposed to be looking for. Do you count on a lot of folks in the area there around the Kankakee River to help the Weather Service stay up to date on some of the observations?
Oh, obviously. And then from the hydrology perspective, we actually have another subset of weather spotters that we call river ice spotters.
Mm-hmm.
The Kankakee River sometimes is prone to ice jams, and unfortunately we had several of them this past winter. Being able to track where the ice is and where it is starting to jam up, which may cause flooding concerns, that's really helpful to us because it's a lot of times ice jams happen in small areas and they're between river gauges, so we can't really tell where the flood impacts are going on. It's a much more difficult flood situation than, you know, a rainfall or snowmelt caused flood, which affects the whole river at the same time. So, you know, anyone who lives along the river and wants to share information about any ice jams they're seeing or flooding, and again, in addition to any type of severe weather that they see, we definitely welcome those reports.
Well, you know, it's always nice to have extra set of eyes out there, people keeping an eye that live in the area, that they're able to be right there where they happen to have the problems, to be able to monitor the situation and then let the folks of the Weather Service know about it.
Absolutely. Yeah, we would love to have gauges on every single creek, on every single bridge, but it's just not something that we have at our disposal, so sometimes we need eyes in between, and we definitely appreciate any reports we can get.
Well, Scott, thank you very much for talking about the changes here. They're important changes that people who keep a close eye on the river levels in the Kankakee River in northwest Indiana should know about. Scott Lincoln is the Senior Service Hydrologist. He's with the National Weather Service Office in Chicago. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us. Tomorrow on the program, we will learn the latest on the iLearn scores that have come out of Indianapolis this week. And we'll also hear from Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson. We hope you can join us.